All right. Well, thank you for organizing this, and thank you for coming out tonight on a Wednesday night. So let me begin where the book begins, okay? I begin the collection, or my introduction to the collection, with lyrics from that particular song, opening salvo, for two reasons. Okay, number one, I found myself listening a lot to the music of Blue Scholars as I was working on the collection. And those of you that know Blue Scholars, I mean, they've been putting out the most radical albums in hip-hop over the last decade. So it was a source of inspiration. The second reason is that that particular song captures many of the themes that the collection tries to address. Right? And very simply, our collection, and it's a collection of essays. I didn't write the book. I wrote the introduction and edited the essays in the book. The Rising Tide of Color tries to lay bare some of the insidious and intricate roots of white supremacy and state violence that have shaped the world that we live in. At the same time, it also seeks to reveal the imaginative and ingenious ways that human beings have pursued a radically different world. And it does so by placing movements of ideas, peoples, policies, and practices across the Pacific and in the American West at the center of the story about race in U.S. history. Now, I think it's really hard to talk about race these days, and I would say having a black man in the White House has actually made that tougher, not easier, right? Because even those who despise Obama, okay, say that his election, and now re-election, proved once and for all that race no longer matters in America. America has moved beyond race. Race is supposedly something from the past, something that doesn't matter anymore in today's America. So by and large, the story of race has become reduced to a story of racial exclusion, that is something that happened in the past, and national inclusion, supposedly the present and the future, a future or a promise supposedly inscribed in the founding of the United States. So the moral of the story is, yes, slavery was bad. America's original sin, as Obama and others put it. But slavery and racism were really not about America. Okay, what it stood for, that's what we're told over and over. That was a betrayal of America's founding principles, supposedly. But beginning with the Civil War and Reconstruction in the 1860s and culminating in civil rights laws in the 1960s, America supposedly began to redeem itself. The U.S. state in particular seemingly stepped forward to advance and sanctify America's commitment to racial equality and racial justice. The federal government finally mustered a national resolve to defeat racism once and for all, to enforce desegregation on an intractable South. So the story goes. Now, that historical understanding, I would say, has been central to making the U.S. state, that is the U.S. government, appear non-racial and even anti-racist across time and space. And many of the essays in this collection challenge that romanticized and simplifying narrative of race in U.S. history. The U.S. government, many of the essays remind us, has been an embodiment, but not only an embodiment, but in fact a leading proponent, an agent of white supremacy in U.S. history. And movements across the Pacific make that history of race and state violence especially clear. Now, to put it another way, our collection aspires to follow what Cedric Robinson calls the Black Radical Tradition, a tradition that Martin Luther King Jr. helped to advance in his lifetime. Not the King of 1963, when he proclaimed before the Lincoln Memorial, as we all know, his dream, quote, deeply rooted in the American dream, that one day this nation will rise up and live out the meaning of its creed, unquote. I'm referring instead to the King of 1967, when he voiced his opposition to the Vietnam War by identifying with the poor people of Vietnam and the United States. Speaking as a citizen of the world, he said, King recalled a larger sense of history, as he put it, beyond the prophesying of smooth patriotism. And he said, I knew that I could never again raise my voice against the violence of the oppressed in the ghettos without having first spoken clearly to the greatest purveyor of violence in the world today, my own government. Now, for King, especially in 67 and 68, struggling for racial justice meant embracing a sense of belonging beyond the U.S. nation state. And not only that, but it also meant confronting the violent machinations of that state. So how would dominant understandings of race, resistance, and the U.S. state look if approached from King's radical insights and from a decidedly Pacific framework? That is the central question that the rising tide of color wrestles with. Now, when I think about race and state power, I find the work of Michael Omi and Howard Winant in their book, Racial Formation in the United States, which was published more than 30 years ago now, I find that book especially helpful. Now, in that book, Omi and Winant propose that we approach race as, quote, an unstable and decentered complex of social meanings constantly being transformed by political struggle, unquote. What does that mean? It means that race has always been in formation, both giving shape to and being shaped by social, economic, and political forces at particular historical moments. And Omi and Winant underscored the dialectical relationship between the state, what they call the racial state, and social movements in defining racial politics in the United States. In contrast to the dominant narrative, Omi and Winant argued that the racial state did not represent or enact a linear progress toward equal rights and democracy. Rather, the racial state was inherently conservative. It has sought to stabilize the racial order through laws, policies, and what they called a repressive apparatus, in response to crises initiated by social movements, most notably the Black Freedom Movement in the middle decades of the 20th century. Sure, the state responded with reforms when compelled to do so, but at the same time, it tried to diffuse and undermine social movements to establish a new, unstable racial order. It's never been a one-way street toward racial equality and racial justice. So in a nutshell, the 9 essays in the collection open our eyes to a series of racial crises of the 20th century, precipitated in no small measure by radical movements for racial justice. So the collection begins with the World War I era, when anti-colonial activists, nationalists, and labor organizers built powerful local movements in Hawaii, the West Coast, and elsewhere. And many of these movements were motivated by and within a trans-Pacific world of migrations, wars, and revolutions. reinforcing the repressive apparatus of immigration laws and military intelligence from the U.S.-Philippine War, the U.S. state mobilized and expanded, fortified its anti-radical laws and agencies in the 1910s and 1920s to suppress movements against white supremacy and colonialism. The racialized targets of anti-radical repression in turn organized creatively around anarchism and communism in the 1930s, exploiting the political and cultural spaces opened up by and foreclosed by the Great Depression and a U.S. liberal state trying to address that crisis. Although local and global cries for social justice and democracy compelled the U.S. state to disavow racism and colonialism in the middle decades of the 20th century, its capacity to carry out and justify violence, especially against people of color, increased to a scale unprecedented in the history of our planet. And we are definitely living through the legacy of that history right now. Now, out of those contradictions emerged interracial and global solidarities in the decades following World War II, in working class neighborhoods, in prisons, in Southeast Asia, even as the U.S. state proved all too effective in making such radical movements illegible and illegitimate. Now, these are the broad historical ruptures, continuities, and dialectics of race, state violence, and radical movements that our collection tries to map. And to give you a more specific sense of what's in the book, Dan Berger is going to come up and talk about his particular essay, he contributed an essay to the collection, and as was said in the beginning, he teaches comparative ethnic studies at UW-Bothell, and his book, Captive Nation, Black Prison Organizing in the Civil Rights Era, just came out from the University of North Carolina Press. So here's Dan to talk about his essay for a little bit.
Thank you very much for coming. Nice to see some familiar faces and a lot of new faces, and really just delighted to be not only here talking about my contribution to the book, but really delighted to be included in the book and the original conference that sparked the book. The book itself is really just tremendously exciting, and for the various shifts that it means, I think, in terms of the history and historiography of a lot of these movements, and thinking through ethnic studies and other kind of frameworks, I think is quite robust. So my chapter, as Moon mentioned, right, comes from this larger project called Captive Nation, Black Prison Organizing in the Civil Rights Era, which is coming out next month, but very soon. And that the chapter in here is you know, one small piece of one chapter in that book. But really looking at the kind of paradox of prison movement, right? I mean, we think of prisons as these kind of static places that, you know, that warehouse people, right? That lock them up and they're sort of restricted in movement, in thought, and in influence. And to some extent, that's true. And to some extent, it couldn't be more false. And so this chapter tries to explore that historically, largely focusing on California. And I think, you know, I'm interested in kind of movement in multiple ways, right? I think first is the literal physical movement. So when you're talking about California in the 60s and 70s and the black population of California in particular, you're talking largely of southern migrants. So there was a kind of physical movement from Louisiana in particular, but Alabama, Mississippi, and elsewhere, to especially Southern California, right, the Los Angeles area. And most of the people who then become sort of leading figures of the Black Power movement, both in and out of prison, are Southern migrants. And I think that experience of movement, of migration, fosters that second sense of movement, which is political movement, right? Social struggles, the radical movements that are such a core piece of that book, of this book. And so I think that experience, right, of kind of outward Southern migration, of of living under the indignities of Jim Crow, and then coming out to California and to the Pacific Coast and experiencing, you know, in supposedly this land of kind of reinvention, right? The kind of originator of a certain kind of post-racial fiction, and actually experiencing a landscape of racial violence, you know, in different ways, but as extreme as anywhere in the South, and particularly through the criminal justice system, right? So everyday encounters with police, and then for many people, the ways that led them into the prison system and the various daily encounters with guards, many of whom themselves were Southern migrants as well, right? So there's a certain kind of importation of a Southern racial regime that also merges with this kind of post-racial ideal that I think excels in California, right? Becomes part of the kind of origin story that California tells itself and tells others. And especially right at this time of kind of civil rights laws that Moon alluded to being enacted as the kind of end of racism. And what I found, right, the sort of prisoners leading the social movements at this time period, the way that they were able to organize and constitute and participate in social movement was by making explicit reference and appeals to slavery, right? So the way to understand imprisonment, right, and the racial disparities of imprisonment in California and around the world was to analyze it through slavery, right? And partly this had a certain kind of shock value because we're not used to thinking about California as a place, as a hotbed of slavery, right, and enslavement. And partly it was sort of understanding, it was sort of the best approximation for naming the sort of carceral state. And by slavery, I want to make a couple points. I think one key point, right, is that their use of slavery was not an argument about profit, but what we might call subjectivity, right? So the people that most developed this idea that prisons were forms of slavery were largely in solitary confinement, right? These were not people that were being exploited for their labor, and their argument was not one that they were being was not one of labor, right? Of forced labor, coerced labor, or anything of the sort. Rather, it was one of a kind of abjection of slavery, right? What people talk about as the social death of slavery. And if you have questions of that, I'll direct you to Stephanie Smallwood. Right, so that's the idea that imprisonment was a kind of total or near total form of abjection, right, of restricted mobility, of denial of any kind of social relationships, and so on, is the value that sort of slavery held, right, as a critique and as an argument. And I think we also should see prisoners as contributing to a certain kind of intellectual and cultural renaissance in the study of slavery and the focus of slavery in the early 1970s in particular. Right, so this was a time period when a kind of whole new set of scholarship on slavery that emphasized the agency of the enslaved, right, that emphasized the kind of self-actions of the enslaved was, you know, gaining popularity in and out of the academy and perhaps reaches its kind of popular zenith in the publication and the airing of the Roots miniseries by Alex Haley. And so I think prisoners, in analyzing their own experience of its, enslavement inside prisons throughout California and really across the country, are part of this kind of cultural and intellectual rethinking about slavery and its afterlives. Right? So my chapter in here, it looks at two of several cases where this played out. One, that of Angela Davis, which is, I'm sure, familiar to many of you here, but young scholar at the time who is arrested for allegedly providing guns in an attempted prison escape, led by Jonathan Jackson, whose older brother George Jackson was one of the sort of leading figureheads of the California prison movement, and certainly a theorist of sort of the connection between prisons and slavery. And the other sort of main case that I talk about is that of the San Quentin Six, who were all comrades of George Jackson's, who were charged with participating in a sort of bloody prison riot the day that he was killed. And in both of these cases, and in countless others, right? The critique of slavery is not just an intellectual critique, but also prisoners adopted the tactics and strategies that slaves, enslaved people used to challenge their own oppression centuries earlier. So in Angela Davis's case, right, we have her writing and her testimony, her kind of intellectual production, right, restoring the humanity of the slave in a kind of social and political landscape that seeks to deny it. In my favorite example, right, the prosecution in her case tried to use letters that she wrote to George Jackson to say that she was so in love with George Jackson, she sacrificed his brother and killed all these people, out of this sort of criminal love. And it's a very cynical and sort of racist depiction of what black love means or looks like. And in response, she and her defense attorneys asked Dalton Trumbo, a sort of award-winning screenwriter who had been blacklisted by McCarthyism, to take those same letters and rework them as a poem. And that became part of the closing statement to the jury. And I think that sort of cultural reworking of love and literature is one that covers a large expanse of the resistance and humanity of enslaved people. And in the same Quentin Six case, right, these were six individuals who were held in total solitary confinement, who were taken to and from court with their shackled at their neck, and then around their handcuffs around their wrists, which were then shackled to their waists, which were also connected to their ankles, right, and sort of marched like that to and from court. And when they got to court, they were then shackled to the tables and chairs where they sat, as well as being gassed on a near daily basis inside their solitary confinement cells. And here again, the kind of visibility of restraint, right, of those chains, of that attack on mobility, I think is one that people in prison learned from and mobilized and leveraged in ways that were very directly conscious of the kinds of radicalism that people who were enslaved had done a century earlier. Okay, so I want to just wrap up by saying a couple of things about what this all might mean for today, which I know sometimes is a sort of risky proposition for historians, but I guess I teach ethnic studies, so it's fine. So I'll say just a couple of things. I think when we're thinking about the carceral state, right, things in most respects have gotten worse now than they were in the time period covered by this book, even though the two cases I write about are actually in a lot of ways victorious, right? Angela Davis is acquitted. Most of the San Quentin Six is acquitted. Half of them are acquitted, and one person is convicted of lower charges. So two of them are convicted of more serious charges. But it is a stunning victory in what was, at the time, the longest trial in California's history. And yet things have gotten worse, right? The kinds of conditions of these six individuals who, you know, held in solitary confinement for years on end, being beaten and gassed on a daily basis, denied sunlight on a daily basis, are actually the norm in prisons around the country, right? And I'm sure folks here know that the U.S. has both the largest and the most racially disparate prison system in the world, and that was largely developed in response to the organizing and activism that I talk about in my chapter, and that also sort of constitute several other chapters in this book. And I think the sort of scenes of contemporary racial violence in places like Ferguson and Detroit and Tacoma and Seattle remind us to expect state violence and social movements in the most unexpected of places. Finally, what I think the example of these sort of prison organizing and prison movements gives us is a long and vital legacy of abolition. And I think from them we see a need to raise a sort of impossible demand, right, of sort of abolition in the days of slavery seeming so impossible, and yet in the days of neo-slavery seeming all the more necessary. Thanks.
All right, thank you, Dan. I spent all afternoon summarizing the 9 essays in the collection, but I don't think I'm going to have time to share those wonderful summaries with you. But let me give you a taste of the collection by talking about the lead essay after the introduction, after the wonderful introduction. George Lipsitz, a leading scholar in the study of race, social movements, and popular culture, he begins the collection with what I think is a piercing essay on the intellectual and political stakes of studying race, state violence, and radicalism in our current political moment. And George Lipsitz grapples with a series of traps that activists and scholars on the left can fall into, where racial oppositional rhetoric, political ideology, and radical posturing can devolve all too easily into individual escapism, anti-democratic dogmatism, and shoddy scholarship. And George penned some memorable insights and phrases along the way in ways that are vintage George Lipsitz. So let me give you some examples from the collection, from his essay. Okay, this is George Lipsitz. Colorblindness is not so much a social theory or moral imperative as a rhetorical prophylactic designed to suppress discussion of race-bound solutions to race-bound problems. That's pretty good, huh? There's another one. Racism is always intersectional. It is the life of the party. It never goes anywhere alone. It augments and exacerbates sexism, class rule, homophobia, ableism, and nativism. Racism, life of the party. All right. This is George Lipsitz again. Yet the privileged are not satisfied with their privileges. They feel they do not have enough, and they are angry. Popular talk, radio and cable television programs, letters to newspaper editors, and miscellaneous tweets and blogs present a constant litany of complaints from what must surely be the most miserable, mean-spirited, miserly, misanthropic, spiteful, sadistic, embittered, and angry group of haves in the history of the world. That's the 1% right there. All right, but George, and I would say the collection as a whole, ends on a hopeful note. And this is, again, George Lipsitz writing. Times of crisis, ferment, and upheaval produce new perceptions, personalities, and politics. They bring to the fore new identities, ideas, and imaginations suitable for fashioning new forms of struggle. The history that we read can be an important part of how we understand the problems of the present, but it cannot. It cannot be a substitute for the history we need to make based on the unique promise and peril of our own time. Now, I can go through the other essays, but the collection covers a lot of different topics from different vantage points. It goes from the Pacific Northwest to Hawaii in the teens and 20s to California, anarchists and communists organizing in the 1930s to Dan's essay and the conjoining of movements against police violence in Los Angeles by gay activists and Mexicans and other people of color, and how those movements came to be disaggregated in the 1950s and 1960s. And it ends with a couple chapters on the anti-war movement during the Vietnam War era that very few people know about, that took place in North America and across the Pacific in places like Okinawa and the Philippines. Right. So all in all, by focusing on historical moments on the Pacific coast and across the Pacific, the essays in the collection really call for interpretive frameworks that go beyond racial exclusion and national inclusion or national redemption. And there were a lot of topics that were not covered. There's a long list of topics and subjects that the collection definitely could have and should have addressed. But, you know, there's a lot of work to be done. And hopefully this collection will help us, can help us figure out new radical possibilities as we move forward. So thank you.